Tonight's reading is by a famous leader and writer and philosopher, Marcus Aurelius. And Marcus Aurelius was writing during a time near the end of the second century of the Common Era, when a plague known as the Antonine Plague was devastating the land. And Marcus Aurelius, it pretty much went during the whole time that he was in leadership. And this is a reading from his book called Meditations. Just a footnote, I often refer to philosophers from the Stoic tradition and some of the other Greek traditions, because I believe, and many scholars do, that they were very much influenced by Buddhist teachings that came through Pyrrho, who was with Alexander, and so forth and so on. So I find that when I read the writings of folks like Marcus Aurelius, that I find that there's the same teaching. It is not death that a man should fear, but he should fear never beginning to live. Let me say it one more time. It is not death that a man should fear, but he should fear never beginning to live. My son and I always have a lot of beautiful things that we share together, and one of those things is a great love for theater. And recently we've been rewatching some classic films on the Criterion Channel. And one of those film series or franchises is the original Planet of the Apes. When I was a young man, the Planet of the Apes was big to me, very important. And as a young filmmaker myself, I would get my friends together and our little Super 8 camera, and we would make Planet of the Apes movies, little short films. So I was a huge fan. I can remember saving all my allowance for like nearly 6 months so I could buy a mask that looked nowhere near as good as the movie, but at least it was sort of a simile of the Planet of the Apes mask. So why do I mention this? Well, we were watching the second film in the series, which is called Beneath the Planet of the Apes. And while we were watching it, without going into too much of the plot, there were things that were happening that resonated with what I wanted to share with you this week. And on the one hand, you have this planet of apes, which actually is Earth, some 2 millennia in the future. And of course, astronauts have landed there, and they have gone back in, or forward in time. And they find themselves in this civilization of apes. And in the second film, they find that there's also another civilization, a subterranean one, that is living in the remains of the New York City and the subway systems. And what struck me was, and if you see the film, I think you'll really get it, and I highly recommend it, is that the apes have a religion. And in fact, in their religion, it's very much what we would say is the Abrahamic faith tradition. But it's also very, very sort of basic and primitive. And there's a sort of fundamentalism that has gone on. And you see this fundamentalism contrasting with the realization that there are humans from another time, that humans can speak, and that even humans preceded this ape civilization, brought about by a great cataclysm that the humans caused for themselves through nuclear war. And so you see this conflict between knowledge and religion. And one of their leaders, he's trying to keep them from knowing certain things because he wants to protect them and keep them innocent. But inevitably, they come into contact and clash with new knowledge and new things that are happening. And what's interesting about the subterranean humans who have been irradiated from living so near this one gigantic cobalt atomic bomb that is called the Alpha and the Omega. And these humans have begun to turn knowledge into a religion itself. So in a sense, you have the ape civilization with a very basic religious tradition, which is very much dogmatically opposed to knowledge and new understanding. And then you have this warped human civilization, the remnants of it, and they are worshiping this atomic bomb as the ultimate height of their achievement through science. So why am I bringing this all up, besides sharing with you my great love of the Planet of the Apes series? Well, I thought it was a nice contrast with the way in which I have been talking a lot about the need for a new spirituality. And this new spirituality, I think, importantly, will be a dynamic made up of two things. One, how things work, or knowledge, and that would mean today science, has to fit like a glove with why things matter or spirituality. But at the same time, while acknowledging this and knowing that this is true, we must also be very clear that on the one side, we will resist this because our religious traditions will find new knowledge and new things, just like in Planet of the Apes when they found talking humans, that go against what they've always known. And there's a sense that they have to sort of protect their religious traditions from this new knowledge. But on the other hand, you have these humans living, you know, in the subway systems of the irradiated New York City, the descendants of the nuclear fallout. But they have now raised their greatest science, which was this bomb, which brought about all their destruction. They have raised it to godlike status. And it's quite eerie if you watch it. They actually do it in the remnants of what would be St. Patrick's Cathedral. And that shows us the other side. You know, we're very used to the idea that with religion, you know, sometimes it dogmatically opposes new knowledge and new understanding and resists evolving. But on the other hand, we have to be very careful that we don't turn science itself into a religion. Because if we do, we will begin to put knowledge and technology above the human. And this we must never do. And in fact, our new spirituality must be a voice that makes this clear. Because if we do not have an established value system, and by that I mean a new form of spirituality that not only holds up why things matter, but equally embraces how things work. That if we don't do that, if there are no values by which to discern our society, then only society will be our judge. Let me say that again. If we do not have a rich spiritual tradition, and I'm not necessarily calling out and raising up any particular tradition, I'm calling upon all of our spiritual traditions to to open up and evolve and realize that it is crucial that we provide values with which to discern how our society is and how our technology is used. Because if we don't, then our society will become the judge. And in that, there will be no grace. So let me talk about the three principles of oneness in this context. Number one, and this kind of goes back to the saying by Marcus Aurelius, suffering shows our oneness. In other words, if we cultivate a noble attitude toward our suffering, and I honestly believe that if you kind of distill the meaning of the Buddha's teaching into a one line, it would be suffering is everywhere. Suffering is found in all areas of life. Choose to live nobly. What does that mean exactly, to choose to live nobly? It means that sometimes we're going to be faced with the impossibility of transforming a situation that's happening to us. We may not be able to change it. We will see the limits of our knowledge and our technology. But that being true, we can always transform ourselves. So while we might not be able to transform the situation we find ourselves in, we can use the situation to transform ourselves. Along with the Planet of the Apes and that apocalyptic theme, I grew up, as many of you may know, in a very pretty fundamentalist Christian tradition. And I don't want to knock it, because there were a lot of beautiful things in it, in terms of community, in terms of the things that the community shared together. And I loved it. I mean, I was one of those weird spiritual kids that loved going to church. And I loved going to Bible. And I couldn't get enough of it. But one unfortunate thing about it was, is that it was an apocalyptic faith. In other words, raised to believe that the end of the world was imminent, that it was going to happen within our lifetime. There were preachers who would talk about this. Some would get more specific than others, but the book of Revelation was often preached from. And I grew up in a milieu of a religious faith that deeply believed that the end of the world was coming. And this might sound strange to you, but I looked forward to it. There were two things that came out of that culture that I was raised in. One was this constant sense that the whole system, everything that everyone else relied on, the political system, the economic system, the world governments, all of those things were corrupt. In some sense, they were corrupt. And that they were all going to fall. And there would be this great time of tribulation. And then there would be a time of rebirth, where there would be a new heaven, a new earth. And so it was strange. On the one hand, it put that in front of you, and you constantly were waiting for the end of the world. And on the other hand, you kind of found it comforting, because you looked around you, and you saw the way things were, and you kind of looked forward to this new idea, this new thing. And there were two forms of that for me. There was what I'm going to call an A form and a B form. The B form of my faith is the one I was just describing. So that's where I thought the end of the world would come at any moment. and it would lead to this great war in heaven, and then there would be this new heaven and new earth. So I didn't really worry about the end of the world in that sense. However, B version, what if I wasn't among the elect? In other words, what if through some sin of my own, I wasn't raptured, I wasn't taken up, and I was left behind? And many of you know the story where I came home from school one day, and I found that the house was open, stuff was cooking on the stove, the TV was on, all these things, but no one was around. I went outside into the yard and no one was around. And I went to the neighbor's house and it was the exact same situation. And I'll never forget coming back to my house and going inside and going up to my bedroom, looking out the window and thinking, I missed it. That some sin I had done had kept me from being part of the elect. And now all my family was in heaven, and I was left behind, and it wasn't going to be pleasant. If any of you have seen the film with Seth Rogen about the end, it's a very humorous take on that vision. And in the B version of that faith, was that once I realized that I was left behind and there was nothing I could do about it, there was a different type of freedom that came in. First there was fear, then there was freedom. And I thought, you know what? Now I've got nothing to lose. I've been left behind. And I lost my fear. And those two faiths for me have kind of worked their way to the surface right now in the midst of this crisis that we're all in. On the one hand, I find myself realizing that, you know, there's probably a lot of things that we should let go. We're never going to be the same after this. We're never the same after some great event, some terrible event that occurs. And maybe some of those things we should let go. Maybe it's time for us to use this period as a way to reflect on our lives, both individually and corporately, and ask ourselves, maybe a lot of things weren't working and we need to use this time to not go back to normal. I know everyone wants things to go back to normal. I certainly want things to go back to a place where people are safe again. But the reality is, I'm not so sure everything should go back to normal. There's a lot of things we were doing that just really didn't work. And I think we can use this time individually and as a community, as a society, to not be too quick to try to restore things just back to the way they were. Because we never will. The idea that somehow we'll return things back just to the way they were and we can just forget about what has happened, that'll never exist. So the A version of being in this type of crisis says to us, maybe some of the old things have to fall away so that new things can come into being. The second principle applies. In that second part, that B part, of embracing this crisis is that even in the most horrible circumstances, and believe you me, when I thought I hadn't been raptured, it was going to be seven years or eight years of hell on earth. But even then, I knew I had the freedom to exercise my will to choose how I would now live. And so, even in the midst of that, and I'm sure you've all experienced it, like when you know the gig is up and there's nothing more you can do, there's a kind of freedom that comes over you. So the B version, we can choose how we're going to now live. And we're going to either use this as an opportunity to bring new things into being. I can change my life. I can use this time as a spiritual retreat and reflect on my existence. Is this the life that I want for myself? Is this the life that I want to live? Or do I want to create something new? And this is the time, this is the place for that conversion of spirit. And as you all are contemplating that, which I hope you will do, and I have done myself, I hope you will embrace the wisdom from the third principle of oneness as it applies here. And that is the essential transformation of our ego self. The actualization of our ego self. And how does that happen? The language we use is that we establish a relationship to our true self. When we establish a relationship to our true self, the ego self is both transcended and at the same time transmogrified. That the ego self, that part of us that is conditioned to be anxious and fearful, that sees survival as its only expression, that world of the ego self, the world of doing and having, that part of this conversion is to transcend that world of doing and having, or not doing and not having, where my entire existence is judged by things outside my control. We open ourselves up to a relationship with our truest self, whatever name you would call that by. In Buddhism, we call it Buddha nature. Others might call it Christ within them. Whatever name you would give to this true self, this is the part of you that is connected to the source and ground of all being. This is the source of our connectedness. That is the source of our creativity and our compassion. And it is only by being in relationship to this true self, by reorienting ourselves to this true self, this sense of being, whereby which nothing in the outside world of doing and having can either add to it or subtract from it. Once we choose to live out of the freedom of a life that is not predicated by the realm of the ego self, then the ego self is itself transformed. Because the ego self isn't the enemy. We just have to change our orientation so that we're not living out of our egos, but rather living out of this deep, centered spiritual ground of being. And how do we do that? Well, we do it through the practices. In Buddhism, we call it the practices of mindfulness and mindful living. But it's really about connecting to something larger than yourself, to an otherness. Not an otherness that is separate from you, but rather an otherness within which you live and move and breathe. And you might express that by deciding to live by certain values, by deciding to live by certain precepts, by deciding to live by a certain path of awakening. And you might express that wisdom through your relationships, through the people that you love, through the people that you hate, and through those who are indifferent. But once we open ourselves up to this deepest, truest nature of our being, we can allow the realm of the ego self to become our manifestation, our actualization. So, in closing, as Aurelius said, none of us want to die, but we all will. And my heart breaks for those who have been lost. And those who are lost before this crisis, and those who will be lost afterward. But it is not death that we should fear. And when we are grounded in our true selves, we realize that there is no real death. And that the thing that we ought to be wary of is not ever having chosen to truly live. So I hope that you will learn to live fully, love freely, and give completely.